Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine. My guest on the line is Tim Couric, who did an unusual thing. He is an evangelical Christian who went underground as a gay person and learned all kinds of things about, well, the evangelical community, the GLBT community, and about himself. Tim, welcome back to the Inside Scoop. So I was asking you before the break, and I have to tell you, I read an article in the Huffington Post about what you did, and the woman who wrote it...
Emily,
She wasn't real happy with what you did. She said that...
She's a friend of mine. Oddly enough, she wrote that before she'd even read the book.
Okay.
So afterwards, she said that there were some things in there that she would have changed.
Well, let me just tell you what she wrote, and then obviously they can judge it for themselves. So she wrote that basically that it was dishonest what you did. That basically you should have just gone in if you wanted to seek understanding, and went in and told people, hey, you know, I'm just trying to understand you. I guess I would respond to her that I understand the difference between jumping into a culture and exploring it from the outside. I mean, if you're white and you're exploring black culture, if you're a man, I mean, there's books about women who dress up as men and men who dress up as women, and people who pretend to be Jewish or not Jewish. So I understand the difference between wanting, I mean, a lot of, I was just thinking about it this way, most of my listeners, not all of them, most of my listeners know I'm openly gay. And if an evangelical Christian comes up to me and wants to talk to me about being gay, I'll talk with them because I'm a talk show host and I'll talk to anybody about anything, and I'll be very nice to them and I'll explain things in a very delicate way, making sure not to offend their sensibilities. Where if someone says to me that they're gay and wants to talk to me about evangelical Christians, I might not be quite as careful. I might make a joke or two. I got to admit that. I'm not going to be quite as careful, perhaps, in the way I portray things. So is that what you were looking for, to get just a real honest portrayal rather than a careful portrayal, or was there something deeper than that?
I believe in full submersion, you know, when you're doing something like this. I mean, obviously, John Howard Griffin back in the late 50s did turned his skin black via dermatological procedure, went down to the Jim Crow South and wrote Black Like Me. You know, and that changed a lot of things, and he was able to speak to, you know, from his limited experience over 6 weeks, speak to the white people in such a way as to say, hey, listen here, you don't understand, just from that limited view that he got. In my situation, there were a few things. First of all, you know, there are a lot of people who could go out and just talk to gay people and have their perspectives be challenged or changed. But I was so deeply entrenched, I was at a completely different place in my life than Emily was in hers. And different people act and operate in different ways and sometimes need different things to really challenge them. And for me, I needed to experience the full experience as much as a straight guy as I could. And part of that was going into the community as somebody who had just come out of the closet and being welcomed and embraced into the community. Now, I did realize very early on that I was a bull in a china shop, and that I hadn't thought beforehand about how potentially insensitive what I was doing could be, and I realized that I needed to be very careful. After that first experience in the gay dance club, I had one gay acquaintance from karaoke that I was on kind of a light friend level, named Sean, and I asked him out to dinner and took him out to dinner and told him about the experiment and asked him if he would help me kind of act as my gay Yoda, teach me, and he ended up becoming my pretend boyfriend. One of the reasons for that was that I didn't want anybody to develop feelings for me or anything along those lines, and then find out that, you know, I wasn't gay and feel like they had been taken advantage of. So, you know, he stepped alongside me and really fully embraced the project and what I was doing, and was there for me and gave me a really good out.
That's a really kind role for this guy to play. I mean, that's a real sacrifice.
Absolutely.
And he did this because he wanted what? You to see that some of the stereotypes you'd heard were not true, or he wanted you to...
Yeah, he wanted to shepherd me through this experience because he's a gay Christian. And he wanted to help me in any way that he possibly could.
Speaking of gay Christians, did you check out gay churches like the Metropolitan Community Church and Dignity and some other go ahead. Tell me about what those.
No, absolutely.
How did
I went
those?
To,
yeah, go ahead.
Sorry about that.
No, no problem.
I even went to a conference out in Jonesboro, Arkansas, at this beautiful little church called Open Door, and I put on a marriage equality event in Memphis, Tennessee, with Jim and Tammy Faye Baker's son, Jay Baker, and. I did a lot of stuff around the religious communities, but the main thing was, you know, on Sundays I did softball. It was the only time I've ever been recruited by a gay man for anything was to be on a softball team, an LGBT softball league. So I did that on Sundays, and I'd been in the church 4 or 5 times a week all my life. So I kind of wanted to get away from church, and then after, you know, being burned by the Christian friends that I had, you know, I felt kind of a need to get away from that. Now, I do want to clarify something because somebody just posted on my wall but on Facebook. But I don't want to stereotype Christians in the same way that that I, you know, was in the past have stereotyped, you know, gays. And the thing about it is I'm speaking mainly to the people who take their conservative Christianity and they allow it to engender certain negative attitudes and actions. And by and large, I know a lot of conservative Christians, I'd say the majority of conservative Christians that are very loving people, even if they have a conservative interpretation of the Bible.
And so, I know a lot of liberal Christians that are terrifically and wonderfully accepting of all the diversity in our lives. So this is definitely not an anti-Christian thing, but it is an anti-intolerance. And I've always said, look, that I hate no one except bigots, and I have no problem hating bigots. You know, I'm tolerant of everyone except intolerant people, and I have no problem being intolerant of intolerance. To me, if you're tolerant of intolerance, that in itself is intolerant, and that's sort of confusing. But that's my point on that. Let me ask you this: the first, so your experience with gay people. You mentioned a dance club, and then you mentioned this very nice guy who pretended to be your boyfriend.
Yeah.
Give me just some of the. I don't know, some of the first expectations when you first walk into a gay bar or you go to a party, what you expected and what you found instead.
Well, initially I didn't know what to expect. There was one time I walked into this bar in here in Nashville called Tribe. That's my favorite bar.
I've been there.
My buddy Will, who I grew up with and is a major character in my book, is one of my best friends. He's a bartender there. I walked into Tribe one night, and there was one of the regulars was having a debate with one of the bartenders about young earth creationism. And the regular was basically saying that he wholeheartedly believed in a literal six-day creation, you know, and seventh day of rest, you know, and as according to Genesis. And that shocked me. You know, I'm walking into a gay bar thinking I wasn't, you know, finding any kind of faith was – I was taught that wouldn't happen. You know, homosexuality and Christianity were mutually exclusive terms. At least that's what I was taught. And so to experience things like that, and then to realize that, you know, yeah, I picked the wrong venue for the first place to go to. I went to Tribe. That was the first place I went to. Club Play. But at Tribe, I found a bunch of business professionals and stuff who were coming to have a drink after work and talk with friends. It's a really safe, comforting environment there and intellectually stimulating. And
Tim, hang on 1 second, because I have a caller on the line, and I want to hear what she has to say to contribute to the discussion. And by the way, anyone who wants to call in can call in at 202-889-9797 and join the discussion. Caller, you're on the air. Tell us your name and what you want to ask Tim or me.
Hi Tim, how are you? My name's Kim Schroeder, and I'm the person that actually posted it on your wall, and I probably went a little overboard, which is kind of my tendency anyways, but I really appreciate what you've done, and how do I put this? I think our experiences are the same. I was a Trinity Evangelical Divinity student when I realized I wasn't eligible for ministry anymore and came out as trans quite a few years after that. Mm-hmm. But I think the phenomenon is that there's a sin that cannot be forgiven, spoken of in Scripture, and I kind of playingly call it not living up to expectations. We have an expectation over how people are supposed to react or respond, and when the Christian community has a difficult time trying to get confronted with the nice side or the nice people that may happen to be gay or not,
Go ahead, Tim.
Absolutely. No, I completely agree with you. I think there's a lot of ignorance on how to react to certain things. And when you put yourself in one social structure, in one bubble, and you don't allow right. yourself to experience diversity as God intended, you pigeonhole yourself and you don't know how to respond or how to engage life and variety and differences in the appropriate way. And I think that's, you know, I was taught to be in the world but not of the world, but nobody ever told me
exactly.
I was still in the world.
Sure.
So how yeah. do we take these two extremely different communities, and they are both communities, even if some people may mm-hmm. be in both yeah. of those communities, that are filled with such fear and such, and I have to tell you, I mean, I assume you learned this in talking with gay people, but there's an extreme amount of fear, particularly in places like Tennessee, that gay people have for evangelical Christians. And there's a fear that someone's going to come into that bar with a gun and start shooting people. I mean, I know that fear exists.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a fear of, I mean, and listen, gay teens, lesbian teens, bisexual, transgender teens even more so, are 3 to 4 to 5 times more likely to commit suicide, more likely to be turned out from their parents on the street, more likely to be like that lesbian woman that you met, Tim. And what possible, I mean, you wrote a book, I appreciate that, but how can we help mutual understanding? I'd be curious if either of you have a comment on that. Let me start with you, Tim, and then I'll get to the caller.
Okay. Yeah, I think the biggest thing that I encourage my friends in the LGBT community to do is to, you know, there are a lot of people who have been really hurt and really damaged, and it's not a safe place for them to be, to put themselves around people who, you know, kind of embody the beliefs that have hurt them. But there are a lot of others who are out there who are a lot more able to function around those communities that are different, you know, that are more conservative. And I tell them, you know, break stereotypes, go spend time with those people, be in and live intentionally in community with those people, and show them that you're not scary, and show them that your relationship isn't perfect, and show them that your relationship, you have no agenda. You know, you come home after work and watch Netflix and make dinner and go to bed, and that your relationships with your partners, you're not having sex every night. You know, you're just like a straight couple. You know, after a while, you know, you're lucky if you can do it once a month.
But
you know?
See, would evangelicals be open to that right. discussion? I mean, I remember, this is already 10 years ago now, when I lived in Los Angeles, and they had a protest against the radio host Dr. Laura. And there's yeah. a huge protest because she's obviously anti-gay, and there were maybe 7,000 people protesting her. Me, I stood with 100 people who were supporting her and was talking and arguing with them. And what I found is at least those people who are actively supporting her anti-gay agenda, the vast majority of them didn't want to have any kind of discussion. They wanted to yell and scream, and they really just wanted to be emotional rather than sit down yeah. and say, what exactly is your issue, you know, and do you really feel that the United States should be a theocratic country like, you know, like the Taliban, where your yeah. biblical thing controls everyone? You know, is that it? If it's not the Bible, you know, and try, but they didn't want to have a rational discussion with me. Caller, do you have any views on this?
Yes, you're going to find that in any group, no matter what. There's always going to be a fringe element that is going to be radical, that is not going to be reasonable, and unfortunately, they're always the voice that tends to speak the loudest, and so you're going to discover that. My wife, we transitioned together. I'm now female.
Okay.
My wife was never Christian in the evangelical sense. I was both. I was an evangelical Christian and LGBT, obviously. She had a suggestion that if somebody really wanted to find out, they do exactly what your guest did, and for 24 hours, dress as the opposite gender. Now, I have a personal feeling that, like any battle plan that never lasts past first contact with the enemy, when you get to know an individual, your stereotypes tend to go away. Now, sometimes they could be
yeah,
nasty
absolutely.
People, but you realize they are just, you know, they are not what they are supposed to be.
Yeah, I've always found that yeah. true, that when you know, people who don't have black friends don't understand the black community, people don't have Latino
right.
friends or Jewish friends or gay friends or transsexual friends, transgender friends, I should say, or Christian evangelical friends, frankly, that once you
right.
meet people
right.
of different backgrounds and communities and walks mm-hmm. of life, suddenly a lot of the stereotypes go away. And and they just become ordinary human beings with all the failings and flaws and good points that every other human being has.
But it's a reciprocal, thing, too.
Go ahead, Tim. Let me hear from Tim, and then I'll get to you in a second. Go ahead, Tim.
Certainly, that's fine.
Go ahead, Tim.
I said it's a reciprocal thing. The other thing is for the LGBT folks, is to realize people that have hurt them usually do represent that fringe element, and that there are a lot of really good people out there that believe really interesting things, and you can be in community with people, and they can love you. And you know, I've got a lot of gay friends that have kind of set out intentionally to be friends with people that are in the evangelical world. And some of their best relationships are with their evangelical friends. They've gotten to see a view of Christians.
Let me tell you something. When I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee, and I'm game to do this, and I'll do it in Nashville if you want me to. But I was in ninth grade, I believe it was. And I was in a debate contest, and I did a piece from Inherit the Wind, which is all about the Darwin, the Scopes monkey trial, and the teacher, John Scopes, who was put in jail for teaching evolution in the 1920s. It's a fantastic play, and I did a piece from it. And in the piece, I played Brady, who's supposed to represent William Jennings Bryan. He was the evangelical who couldn't accept evolution and was cross-examined by the Clarence Darrow character. I remember being asked, you know, what a friend of mine did the play together, you know, what time did the earth begin? I said 9 a.m. because you had to give a specific time the earth began. Anyway, I really enjoyed it. I got second place in the contest. But what I remember is not the contest, but afterwards, because I did this at Ezel Harding School, which I just thought was Ezel Harding School, and I didn't realize it was Ezel Harding Christian School, because I didn't make a distinction between them. And afterwards, people came up to me and they said, "Hey, Mark, you know, we really enjoyed the piece. That was really good." I said, "Yeah, I really enjoyed it because I was playing a role of someone that I fervently disagree with, and it was fun to take on that role," which shocked the people. They said, "Well, you don't believe man came from monkeys, do you?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I do believe in evolution." And then they found out I was Jewish, and they spent really the whole next hour and a half trying to convert me. And my teacher was all nervous for me. I loved it because that's, I guess, the kind of person I am. And I was, you know, and I know the Bible well, both Old and New Testament. And I was throwing stuff back at them. And a couple of girls went to my feet and were praying for me. And so I said a prayer for them in Hebrew. And we had a great conversation that I loved. But I don't know that I changed any minds. I like to think I did, but yeah. I can't know when they came home and they just said, "Hey, we met this crazy Jew who believes in evolution." How do you actually get past all the rhetorical barriers that I faced, that they faced, where you're not talking at each other and past each other, but with each other? Is it about sharing things, breaking bread together, or sharing a tragedy, enjoying a concert? I mean, is it about seeing people in ordinary light? Is that how you get past all these wonderful, philosophical debates that never seem to convince anybody?
Humor
does it. All right.
Yeah, humor does it.
Well, go ahead, Kim. Let me get Kim first, and then I'll get Tim. Go ahead, Kim.
Yeah,
so absolutely. Humor's the answer.
I have discovered, somebody will ask me, okay, well, what it's like? What was the major change that made you become female? I will typically answer, well, it means you could forget about voting Republican ever again. And that usually gets a laugh out of everybody, and it breaks the ice, and you get to see that, you know, there really is a person behind the weird rhetoric.
Tim, what do you think? Let me get Tim's view. Go ahead, Tim.
I think you don't talk about the issue at hand. You do life together. You live and experience mundane things together. Yeah, you go get coffee, you talk about work, you talk about these different things, but you make a point not to try to start a polarizing conversation.
Right.
Before you can really have that conversation and actually do any good, you have to start a foundation of trust, mutual respect. And nobody ever changed their beliefs because they lost an argument. You know, and so I think it really does amount to going and getting coffee, going and seeing a movie, and just having a casual friendship, and then also, you know, having a deep friendship, being able to go through chat tragedies and relying on each other and you know, all sorts of things like that.
Absolutely.
So
Tim,
Desmond Tutu calls it Ubuntu.
Tim, you only gave me an hour, but if you can give me a little bit more, I do want to ask you a little bit about coming back to the straight community and the evangelical community and how they dealt with you after you said that this was all just a test on their part. Can you give me about 15 more minutes, or do you really have to go?
Yeah.
You can?
All right. I can give.
Terrific. Then I'm going to take another break, and when I come back, I'm going to find out how Tim exited, or to some extent, the gay community, and what kind of reaction he got to that. I can imagine it was quite extreme. Kim, you're welcome to stay on the line if you want, or if not, you can go away and keep listening online, whatever you wish.
I think your guest has been very good, and I'd like to give him the floor and the opportunity to continue.
Terrific.
So I will stick by.
I want you to stay on, though.
Kim, whether you stay on or not, it's up to you.
Sure.
I got to go to a break because it's the top of the hour. We'll be right back with more of the Inside Scoop right after this. Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine. I have a very interesting guest on the line. His name is Tim Couric, and although he hails from an evangelical Christian background, he decided to pretend to be gay for a year. Was it a year, Tim? A whole year?
That was a year.
Did this in order to find out more about the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender community. Found out that, gay people, lesbian, bisexual, transgender are pretty much just like every other human being, with all the good, bad, and the ugly of every other human being has. But he did find out that his church community was not as tolerant, perhaps, as he had hoped. But now, after a year, he has to come back. And Tim, here's a problem. So, you know, we in the gay community are constantly telling people this isn't a choice. This is just how we're born. And so you've got to accept us because it's like race or anything else. It's not our choice. A transgender community is constantly saying, you know, I was born this way. I want to be I consider myself a woman or a man. I was just born in the wrong body. So gay people, GLBT people are constantly fighting this battle. And yet you actually did make a conscious choice. You did it for understandable and political reasons. But I would think that you got a lot of hostility when you came back and said, hey, I was just doing a test for a year. How did people react when you told them that?
I'll say this first. Before, during my year, one of the things that I really realized was that I went back at one point after I'd gotten completely comfortable and my comfort zone had expanded to fit the LGBT community, and I had changed a lot of my beliefs, and a lot of things had become clear to me. I went back and visited the church that I had worked at, and when I went there, I realized that it wasn't the church I worked at; it was another church. But I went there, and I realized that I had all of this animosity towards the church and was judging them and looking at them the same way that I had looked at gay people before that. And I had this epiphany, and a second epiphany, that I had not conquered my prejudice or my bigotry, that I had just switched the object of my prejudice and bigotry back onto the church. And so the book and the experience to me ended up being more about the nature of prejudice and why we have to feel there needs to be an enemy in our lives and why we have to be separated from each other, more so than even the issue of homosexuality and faith. But when I did come back out of the closet, the coming out, the second coming out, the first real authentic coming out experience that I had coming out of straight, I was more concerned with what my LGBT friends were going to think of me than I was what any of the Christian people that I had told would think of me.
And I suspect you got a very strong reaction, positive and negative, from people in the GLBT community, right? Some supported your going undercover, and some said, wait, you told us all these lies?
People who knew me, I mean, the people that were in my life that were LGBT, they knew me. I had poured myself into that community and wasn't hiding. The only thing different about me was the label of my orientation. And so when I came out and told them that I was straight and I told them what I had done, I was met with an overwhelmingly positive response because they knew me. You know, they knew my, they could tell what my motivations were. They could tell what I was trying to do. And I'm still very good friends, closer than ever before, with a lot of people that I became friends with during my year.
Did anybody doubt you? Did anyone say you're just pretending to be straight to get back in the Christian community, but we really think you are gay?
No, nobody who knew me accused me of anything like that. Most of the criticisms that I've gotten like that have come from people on the internet who haven't read the book, haven't thought to maybe just talk to me.
Okay.
I'm very easily, you know, accessible online. But,
and how did your parents and brother and church then deal with you when you told them about your experiment?
I still haven't really talked to anybody from my church.
You've been sort of excommunicated
here and there,
informally.
Yeah,
excommunicated.
Well, no, not really. I about 4 months after my experiment ended, 4.5 months, I decided that I needed to get out of the religious subculture of the Bible Belt, and I needed to go experience a different place, and wanted to go somewhere that was kind of the antithesis of the Bible Belt. So I moved out to Portland, Oregon, and so after that, you know, there's certain, you know, once somebody, this group of people hadn't been alive for over a year at this point, and I moved, you know, and that was almost 3 years ago now. I haven't really talked to many of them. I've seen a few of them here and there, and it's been very cordial. And here's the thing, most of those people, when I went back and visited my church during my year, they were very cordial to me. They were very loving towards me. They weren't bad people. It was just the barrier that existed because of the theological, you know, stance that they took that that kept us separated. And that's the whole point of everything for me in my mind is we use things, we allow things to separate us from one another, and that's not God's plan.
So what's your plan then for the future, Tim? How do you plan, and I know it's almost an impossible task, but it seems to be the one that you've set your life course on. How do you plan on increasing understanding between two communities who, let's face it, strongly at least fear each other? They don't. Sometimes it goes to hate, but certainly two communities who, at the nicest, you could say, are extremely wary of each other. How do you breach that seemingly impossible, as you say, theological gap?
Well, I like to think about it in terms of like shadow puppets. It's like there's a sheet up in between the two communities, and when the light is there in the right way, somebody's hand can look like a huge monster, you know. And what I want to do is take the sheet down in any way I possibly can, whether that be through introducing evangelical individuals to LGBT individuals or vice versa, by going and speaking, by interviews like this.
Well, that's a strongly worthwhile goal. Let me just quickly, I've got a caller on the line. She called before. Kim, by the way, I don't even know, because I may have missed this, but where are you from?
I'm in the Chicago area.
Okay. And you have just completed a male-to-female transition?
It's very, very close to complete, but
okay.
Yeah, I'm pretty much all there.
And are you someone that has followed Tim in the past and what he's done? And this is your first chance talking to him? I don't know your...
This is the first time I've spoken with him, and I'm really grateful for the opportunity. I read the piece also in the Huffington Post, and it really kind of kicked my interest in. I could see where he would have received a lot of criticism, but I can only applaud the fact that you know, something like this was actually done.
So at the end of the day, you applaud what he did, and you think it was done for
sure,
the right reasons and so forth. Let me ask you this. Now, you are transgender in Chicago. Chicago, one would think, is a heck of a lot more liberal than Tennessee, and yet even in Chicago, heck, even in San Francisco, I would bet, might be the most liberal city in the United States, transgender people have it even harder than gay people. I mean, I think it's fair to say that y'all get the worst of it.
They do, we do, but I have to say, I live in the north suburbs of Chicago. I'm not in an urban setting, and this is very conservative, but I have to tell you, I don't know whether it's age or what it is. I've got some other theories on it, but I have no problems at all.
Really? That's terrific.
Accepted.
I'm really
no
glad to hear that.
No one bothers me.
I'm really glad to hear that. And I actually think America's grown up a bit. If you look at whether it's views on same-sex marriage or just culturally, you look at, I mean, there's still too many stereotypes in my view in Hollywood, but at least after Will and Grace, I mean, even Joe Biden cited Will and Grace, that culturally people are starting to understand each other a little bit better. And I know that when I talk to audiences, the people in their 60s and 70s still don't get it, but I don't know hardly anyone under 30 that doesn't get it. Even Christian evangelicals, this is a question I want to turn back to Tim. It seems to me that young people today, and let's just say people in their teens and 20s, even in the Christian evangelical community, seem far more accepting of GLBT people than they were 10 years, 20 years ago, and certainly 30 years ago.
Oh, absolutely.
Tim, do you think that's true even in the most conservative Christian churches?
Yeah, and I think the reason for that is that it's becoming, there's still places and there's still instances where it's not safe for people to come out of the closet. But by and large, I feel like it is becoming safer. And so as more people come out of the closet and are open and able to be who they are, which is a beautiful thing, and as you know, equal rights and stuff kind of progress in the country, in this country, and across the globe, it's becoming more mainstream, and people are starting to see what we were talking about earlier about putting. We have to be intentional in each other's lives and live in that tension, and I think people are seeing that there's nothing to be afraid of, that just because the state declares that it's legal to be, you know, for two people of the same gender to be married, doesn't mean that the apocalypse is going to happen the next day.
Kim,
I think that young people are seeing that.
Yeah.
Kim, you want to say something?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm in my mid-50s right now, and, you know, like I came to Christ personally just through reading the Bible when I was in 1978-79. What I have noticed over the long haul is that the same thing is happening now that it happened to my generation when it came to women leaders in the church. Leadership in the church was strictly men. You would not see anybody supporting a Sarah Palin back in the day in the early 80s. It just would not have happened. But for us, for my generation, that was a non-issue. You know, we had grown up with women as equals for the most part. And I suspect that the same thing is coming true now, that this current generation is looking at my generation, the 50s group, and saying, you know, well, just let's just let them talk, and sooner or later they'll be gone, and things will be okay.
Yeah. Let them die out.
I got to tell you that politically, I work in Washington, D.C., and I remember very clearly a 2004 election where, and I don't know that it was so much George W. Bush, though he definitely let it happen. Certainly the advisors behind him, the Karl Roves of the world, said attacking gays, that is a huge political issue, and we can rev up people, and the majority of Americans are against same-sex marriage.
Well, you can raise marriage. A bunch of money that way.
Absolutely. And in 2004, there were some 35 states or so that banned marriage equality and all that. And then in 2008, there was a lot less of that, and people were like, well, we don't know which side people are on. By 2012, the next presidential election, it seemed that opposing marriage equality was actually a negative. Barack Obama came around. I'm a fan of Obama, but I am cynical enough to recognize that Obama recognized and supported marriage equality almost exactly the same time the polls showed that 51% of Americans supported marriage equality. And so the president did, too. Now, I have no doubt that President Obama in his heart always supported it, but the fact that he didn't feel he could politically say so until 51% of Americans said so, I mean, I think we're really coming to a dramatic change. And I guess my last question for you, Tim, and I know you have to go and I've held you over, but my last question for you is, with this change, a lot of evangelicals now are starting to see themselves as under siege. I've heard them. I hear right-wing talk radio, and I hear them say, you know, people are intolerant of Christians, and the gay community have an agenda, and they're out to get us, and the president now supports same-sex marriage, and our lives are in danger, our faith is in danger, our way of living is in danger, and they feel some of the same, and I think wrongly so, but I don't doubt that the feelings are real. I don't think they need to fear, but I do think that their feelings are real. I don't doubt that they have them, where they feel scared and under siege. What can an enlightened, shall we say, or that's a pejorative. Let's say a person who has seen both sides or both communities like yourself, Tim, what can you tell an evangelical Christian who fears that his or her way of life is under siege by the gay agenda? What can you tell them to make them feel a little more comfortable?
I think it has to do a lot with Well, first of all, fear. We use fear in this country as a tactic to keep things the same or to try to change them. I also think that a lot of people in the evangelical community don't want to be looked at as hateful bigots because of their interpretations of Scripture. And there are a lot of people, like I said, that aren't hateful bigots just because of their interpretation of Scripture. Now, I don't agree with them on their interpretations of Scripture, but I think that it's important to come to this conversation with a mutual respect. I was on an interview and I had a caller call in and say, oh, I just feel bad for all the religious people. And then he goes in and starts talking about how beautiful diversity is. And at the end of the call, I said, well, you know, I really appreciate what you said about diversity, and it is a beautiful thing, but look at how you opened your comment. I feel sorry for the religious people.
Tim, one second. I have another caller on the line that I just, before we end this discussion, I want to give this person a voice. The new caller, who are you?
Hi, Mark. It's Michael S.W. from New York City.
Hey, Michael from the Bronx. Did you have a quick comment on Tim's story?
Yes, I do. And you know something, Tim? You are very courageous, my friend. I mean, the thing is that I'm Catholic, and it just is beside me that there are Catholics who do not see eye to eye in terms of Scripture and the ultimate commandment of Jesus the Christ that says, love one another. And the Catholics that go about preaching themselves to be Christian, but yet they're going to be bashing gays, denying their rights, particularly rights to privacy, and want to throw stones at them, as Jesus also said, let the one without sin cast the first stone. How can you go about calling yourself, not you, but calling yourselves Christians, and yet you do not follow the teachings and the examples and the commandments that Jesus taught us to do?
Let me give
Tim
a chance to answer.
Love one another. That means love one another and respect one another's rights.
Michael, let me give Tim a chance to answer. Go ahead, Tim.
Yeah, that's a really deep question. The evangelical or the part of the hyper-conservative church that I was raised in would tell you that loving one another means being honest with one another and taking a stand for what they consider to be truth, which is that homosexuality is abominable. For them to tell you that is for them to show you love. I don't agree with that. I think that we live in a very pluralistic society, and God wants us to learn from each other. And here's the thing. Those people are discounting the fact that the Holy Spirit still, you know, works, is at work. He's not retired, you know, and he's still working actively in people's lives, at least I believe. And so I think that, yeah, that's the great commandment. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul. Love your neighbor as yourself. And what does it mean to love your neighbor as yourself?
You have them do unto
we can't
you.
Deny rights. We can't sit back and say, well, I'm entitled to this, but you're not allowed to. Even though you pay your taxes and even though you're a monogamous consenting adult, your life is less valid than mine.
So
it's about restoring and allowing people to have the dignity that's inherent to their humanity. Everybody's born with the imago Dei, the image of God. We all have dignity.
Tim, I know I have to wrap this up, but let me just ask you, because this is something I've found really difficult, and I don't know if you have an answer for me. So when you have someone from the Christian evangelical community that basically says, if you don't accept my right to be intolerant, you're being intolerant. If you don't accept that I don't believe that gay people should have equal rights in America, then somehow you're intolerant. It kind of reminds me of the old white supremacists that say, hey, the Southern way of life is mistreat black people, and if you don't like that, then you're a bigot. How do you deal with people who say, look, my Bible teaches me gay people are evil or wrong or sinful and that's my belief, and if you challenge that belief, well, then you're the bigot. How do you answer that question?
There's nothing wrong with challenging somebody's belief as long as we challenge it and give them the respect that we want to be given ourselves. It's one of the most fundamental principles in every religion and just common sense. Treat others the way you want to be treated. And there's really not an easy answer for that. If somebody believes that I'm being intolerant by being an advocate for equal rights, I don't quite understand how that's possible.
Me neither, but that's why I asked you.
They've got to understand that if we can withhold the rights of millions, politically speaking, of millions of individuals in this country to pay taxes and can go serve in the military and all these different things, their rights at some point in the future take away on the extreme. And I would just logically gather that maybe their thought should be protecting those rights would be the most fundamental kind of Republican value that they could have, where government doesn't get to determine how you live your life. You know, the government can't tell you if your relationship is valid or not.
That borders what I tell people. I say, look, I believe in the separation of church and state. I do not like theocracies, whether they be a Muslim theocracy, a Jewish theocracy, or a Christian theocracy. I believe that we all should have freedom of religion. And once, if you believe in that too, then my belief is this. You can teach in churches whatever you want. You can teach hatred in your churches. I don't like it, but if you want to teach that gay people are sinful, if you want to have all white churches, again, I think it's atrocious, but you have the right to whatever you want in your church. I have the right to teach whatever I want in my synagogue. But when it comes to the state, when it comes to the government, everyone has to be treated equally under the law. And if you can accept that, look, I don't agree with a lot of religious practices of a lot of religions, including some of my own. All right? I don't even keep kosher. All right. Maybe I'm a bad Jew.
Yeah.
But the point is that it within the religion. You could, as far as I'm concerned, I'm an American. You could teach whatever you want within the walls of your church, within the walls of your religious school. But when you come out into the general community, now we all have to meet on an equal playing field. Otherwise, we can't live in this country together, and you need to go off and form your own religious commune on some island somewhere where you're, you know, go to Jim Jones if you want in Guyana. But wherever it is, then you want to live in a theocracy.
You know something, Mark?
Yeah.
If I can jump in.
Yeah, go ahead, Michael.
Three things. Number one, it's funny that you posed that question to Tim about blacks, since I am a black man.
That's true.
Yes, because you see my picture. Number two, it is so, I find it so funny that, you know, the church, and, you know, even though I'm Catholic, you know, I got to stand up, you know, for the truth that, you know, the church would condemn homosexuality, but yet you still keep hearing all these scandals of, you know, pre-sex scandals touching children or even get involved with young women, and no one wants to seem to address that or take care of those aspects. Again, that the one who without sin cast the first stone. But then the significant thing is that we hear the Catholic Church constantly, how should I say, raising the roof, if you want to use that term. I don't want to say raising hell. When it comes to contraceptives,
right.
You know, contraceptives,
yeah.
First they want to say that they want less government. They don't want the government prying into their right to practice their religion, their religious beliefs and their faith, and don't want to be touching the issue of contraceptions or birth control. But then yet they want the government to intercede in trying to stop abortions,
right.
And overturn Roe v.
See,
Wade.
See, my view is very simple. The government should be neutral. The government should be neutral among religions, shouldn't favor one, should allow all religions to teach whatever they want, shouldn't favor one or another, shouldn't prevent religious teaching. But when it comes to the law, everyone is equal under the law.
But you know how
I got into this discussion, Michael, because I promised Tim an hour, and I've already kept him an hour and a half.
So, let me say something else about that there really quick.
Yeah, real quick.
In the words of my favorite president, President Josiah Bartlett from The West Wing.
Okay.
there's a difference between separation of church and state. Yeah, that exists. But there's not a difference. There's not a separation of church and politics. And so people's religion and their religious beliefs affect their politics.
They do. So, but it's just, to me, maybe it's because I'm a basic liberal. The answer is I have the right to say whatever I want. I have the right to throw my fists as much as I want because I'm a crazy dancer. But when they get close to your face, my rights end. And I can advocate whatever I want. But when I start advocating that some Americans are treated differently or second class or unequally from other Americans, that's where advocacy ends and bigotry begins. So
absolutely,
I want to thank everybody. I got to say something. This is great. When we look at just the diversity of this phone call, we've got white and black, male and female, straight, gay, transgender, Christian, Jewish, Catholic. I think we got all bases covered. So I want to thank all
Democrat.
Three of you, Democrat, and
Democrat.
I don't think any of us are Republicans. That's the one base we don't have covered.
Yeah.
But I have them on my show too, so that's fine. I want to thank all of you, Tim. I want to thank you especially for staying on a half hour longer than you told me you had. I want to thank Kim for calling in from Chicago, Michael from calling in from the Bronx. All three of you, we're going to take a break. There's still going to be another half hour of the Inside Scoop. Kim and then Michael, if you want to call back and talk about the other topics, I'm fine with that because I want to talk about the Time Magazine cover story on healthcare and at least take the last half hour to do that. So that's the topic for the next half hour.
Sure.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Kim. Thank you, Michael. And we'll be back. We're back with more of the Inside Scoop right after. Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. This is your host, Mark Levine. I want to thank my guest, Tim Couric, for a very fascinating hour and a half, and also to my callers, Kim and Michael. Michael, I understand, is still on the line because he wants to delve into my next topic, which and I'll bring him back on in just a second, but I want to introduce my next topic. For those of you who haven't read the cover story in Time magazine, it is well worth your time. Yes, it is the longest article in Time magazine history. Trust me, it's still worth your time. We all know that healthcare costs are out of this world. We all know that they're through the roof. But do you know why? Do you know who profits from it? Weirdly enough, it's really not only or even mostly the insurance companies. Yes, I know the insurance companies profit a lot from it, but I attack insurance companies all the time. It seems that the, quote, nonprofit hospitals, unquote, are the biggest profiteers. Irony upon ironies, charging 50 times the cost of basic things, taking a little gauze strip that you can buy for a penny or two and charging $77. It's as you go through the article, it makes you wince, it makes you angry, it makes you want to throw things, and it makes you realize that Obamacare is just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, thank God we have it and some people will be able to pay these bills, but the problem is not so much that people can't pay their bills. The problem is the bills themselves. If they weren't through the roof, maybe we could have more Americans pay them. And when you look at all the budget conversations, and of course we have the sequester that's coming March 1st, and it doesn't look like anyone's going to stop it. I don't know. We'll see in about a week. But what's the main cost? Healthcare costs. Social Security is easily not a problem. We got more than enough money for Social Security for decades to come. Medicare is the problem, because Medicare is paying too much. And then when you read the article, you find out that the private industry charges not just Medicare too much, but all of us 10 times what Medicare pays. And they do it all behind the curtain, and they do it all hidden. And you probably knew it was all true, but when you read the article and the specifics are given, I got to give Stephen Brill a lot of credit. This, I think, can, if we talk about it, change the debate in Washington. I'll give you an example, by the way, from my own life. My health care insurance was going through the roof. In 5 years, it tripled. It went up 40% 1 year, and then another 40% another year, and another 40%. And I asked about switching plans, because I couldn't afford to pay these high insurance rates. They're way over the top. And I didn't want to pay three times what I'd paid before. And so the new plan wouldn't provide for the drug I take. I take cholesterol medication because my cholesterol's high. It didn't provide for that. So I want to know what the cost would be under the new plan. So I call up my insurance company, and this is the insurance company, by the way, that is under the old plan and the new plan. I'm not even changing insurance companies. And I say, if I switch to this new plan, a cheaper plan that basically just takes care of me if there's a catastrophe, how much will my drugs cost? They can't tell me. I'm like, well, how much will it cost? That you have a number. How much will it be? They don't know. How can they not know? Well, once you order the drug, then we can tell you how much it costs. And I said, well, wait a minute. That's like saying buy the car first and then we'll tell you the cost later. Or like the next surgery I had, go in, get the surgery first, and then we'll tell you how much it costs. I don't write blank checks ever. Tell me how much it costs. They wouldn't tell me. They then told me that if I contacted the pharmacist, that maybe they could tell me. So I call the pharmacist, and the pharmacist says, nope, the insurance company has to tell you. So then the insurance company says, if I switch to the new plan and then I order the new drug, then they'll be able to tell me and I can switch back if I don't like it. So I go ahead and I make the switch, and then I call. And they still can't tell me until I order it. So I order it thinking, well, I could cancel it otherwise. And then I find out that, yes, indeed, the cost of my medication is going up from about, $25 a month to about $250 a month. Yikes! Luckily for me, I then go to a Canadian website and find out that I can get the exact same drug in Canada for much, 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 much less. Now, my parents are worried about that. Can I trust the Canadian medication? Obviously, I'm going to have to ask my doctor and find out that it's okay. But I'm going to do my best never, ever, ever to buy medicine from American Drug Company again. Not only because it's the price is through the roof, but also because they won't tell me the damn price. You know, when I go to a restaurant, I don't know about you, and they say that the lobster is market price, I ask them what that is before I order the lobster. Because I don't want to order the lobster, and then they'll come back and say, that was a $150 lobster, sir, right? The fact that we can't even know the prices before we pay is exactly part of the problem. So, yeah, I support Obamacare. Yeah, I'm glad that middle class and lower middle class people will be able to buy health care. But still, 60% of American bankruptcies are caused by people not having the ability to pay these exorbitant rates. So the real problem is this. And I don't know why this Time magazine article didn't come out, frankly, 3 years ago. I mean, better late than never. I give them, I mean, better now than never. But really, this is the issue. And I got, maybe I'm crazy, but I actually think this is something that Democrats and Republicans could actually come together on if they just realize this isn't about government intervention or, right, Republicans are saying we don't want the government to choose our health care and blah, 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 blah. The answer is exorbitant costs. And there's just no, you know, if Congress were simply to pass a law that said, you know what, hospitals, you can charge the cost that you pay for something plus 10%. 10% is a damn good profit on just about anything. You know, we could ask for 10, they'll demand 300% and we'll settle on 20%. But whatever it is, charging seven times the rate of something, it should not be lawful, particularly for something that you can't help. You can go to another car dealership and get a different car. When you're in the emergency room, you can't really say, sorry, don't save my life. I got to go to this cheaper hospital down, you know, three states from here. So I really hope that this article begins a national conversation where all of us are aware, first of all, of what the hospitals are doing. We do need to look at the man behind the curtain. He's very important. He's called the charge master, and he's charging us through the roof. I remember when Michael Moore did his healthcare movie, and people were just, oh, well, it's Michael Moore. Well, no, Michael Moore was very clearly talking about the cost of healthcare. And it's time for everyone to talk about that, even the president. Yeah, Obamacare is better than what we had beforehand. But let's not pretend that we've even gone half the way to making sure costs are reasonable. Where's the antitrust department? Where's the Justice Department? Why aren't we going after these hospitals saying, you can't charge that much, you can't do 1,000% markup, and you can't, how about if we just require a law requiring hospitals to put out a price sheet? Just make it public. Yeah, if a piece of gauze costs you $100 per piece of gauze, but you can go down to CVS and buy yourself 100 pieces of gauze for $1.25, and you can bring that into the hospital and use it yourself, guess what? You just saved yourself $1,000. So maybe just transparency is the key, and that's why I'm a real big fan of this Time magazine article. If you want to call in and comment, it's 202-889-9797, 202-889-9797. Michael from the Bronx has called back. Originally, we were talking to Tim Kirk, but I know he has a comment on this as well. Welcome back to the Inside Scoop, Michael.
Hi. Thanks, Mark.
Sure.
You know, the experience that you had just described is primarily why, if you recall, a few years back at President Obama's address to Congress, what did he say? He said, I am not looking to put insurance companies or pharmaceuticals out of business or out of the job. I just want to hold them accountable. And this is what you're complaining about, accountability. The fact that they're going to pull this crap on you, saying they don't want to tell you how much this or how much that is, and then you as a consumer, you as an American, have the right to know what you're dealing with so you can weigh your options. To me, they just violate your rights, and that's a primary problem and the reason why Obama is going after them. And
see,
I can't
look. I've praised Obamacare. You've heard my show for many years now, mm-hmm. Michael, and you know that I'm a supporter. But it seems to me that what President Obama did, honestly, is he started in the middle of the discussion and then walked back. And then Obamacare, you know, if the goal is 100%, Obama started at the 50-yard line and settled at the 20-yard line. I mean, I'm glad that there is some restrictions on increasing costs. I'm glad that the 50 million Americans without health care will be able to get it. Those are all big benefits of Obamacare, along with restricting insurance company profits, allowing young people in the age of 26 to stay on their parents' plans. These benefits are definitely good. No one's knocking them. But the real problem, I don't know if you had a chance to read this Time magazine article yet, Michael, but you really need to do it. The real problem is that these are measures that help us deal with an underlying systemic problem of monopolies run amok.
Yep, exactly. And the funny thing is that while they're doing all this, and the way I see how they're doing it is more of like behind the scenes, you still have these pundits on the microphone airways saying, we got to do away with Obamacare. We got to repeal Obamacare, even after the Supreme Court have ruled that Obamacare is the law of the land. And then when you ask any of these right-wingers, do you know what the Affordable Care Act is? Chances are they won't know it. And then you ask them, oh, do you know what Obamacare is? Oh, yeah, well, I know what that is. We got to do away with it. And then not even realizing that the two are one and the same. It's just that they've been so doggone gullible and so behind the times, they're falling for the likes of the Rush Limbaughs, of the Sean Hannitys, the people on Fox News that constantly call it Obamacare and don't even have the audacity to properly call the medical law as it is, the Affordable Care Act.
That's true. Although I've gotten used to it. I'll tell you why. Basically, when President Obama said, you know what, I don't mind the title Obamacare because it basically says Obamacare, I'm like, okay, we've given it up, so I've actually used the name myself. I want to get to another caller, though, so thank you for your call, Michael.
Absolutely,
I always appreciate
buddy.
You calling in. Let me go to Colin. I believe this is the Colin from North Dakota, if I'm not wrong. Colin, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah. Hello?
Hello. You're on the air. Welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Yeah, I wanted to challenge this thing about Obamacare.
Okay.
I mean, this drives me crazy. This is why the left always loses, even when they win.
Okay. Is not the Colin of North Dakota. Where are you from, Colin?
Dan from Virginia.
Dan from Virginia. I'm sorry. I was told you were okay. Colin. That was a mistake. Go ahead, Dan.
Look, Obamacare basically is what Hillary ran on. So she gets eight,
that's true.
She gets 18 million votes. Running on exactly with the mandate,
right?
But when Obama does it, it's not. All of a sudden, it's mass hysteria on the right, on the left. That's when you say he started at the 50-yard line. He started where he knew Congress was. That's how it comes down. If you wanted more, you had to put your foot in their butt. That was the Senate. The Senate turned down prescription drugs.
I know that.
The Senate. Well, I mean, that's what I'm saying. But when you help the whole. You help them keep the stranglehold when you focus on one Obamacare.
But Dan, here's my point. Here's my point. All right, look, it may well be that the Affordable Health Care Act was, at the end of the day, the very best President Obama could have gotten from Congress. I know he worked very hard on it. It required the 60-vote Democratic Senate that we had for a few weeks in between Ted Kennedy's death and Scott Brown's election. It was a very short period of time. Maybe that is the best we could have gone for. But in my view, President Obama's mistake, and you're right that it was Hillary Clinton's plan, and you're right. I just think he should have started on the 80-yard line, or the 30, if you will, the 30-yard line of the opponent's side.
But the thing is, you don't know if he did or not.
Well,
he's behind the scenes, you don't know if he did.
Well, but I want to do it publicly.
Talking in public doesn't tell you whether him debating in public doesn't tell you where he was.
But Dan, the public debate matters. That's why I actually think President Obama has learned this lesson, which is why when it came down to the fiscal cliff, you found President Obama going around the country and talking in public and finally the Republicans backed down.
He talked about health care, too.
But why didn't he cite England and France and Canada and Costa Rica and universal care? And why didn't he make clear, like this article, this great article in Time magazine, why isn't President Obama using, I mean, he's got great advisors. They can find this stuff. Why isn't he citing a piece of gauze that costs $100 the way this writer does in Time magazine? My point is that if he'd started at 75 yards down the field, then maybe we could have settled for 50. I think he started at 50 and only got 20.
Not with Congress that's going to work for the medical industry, just like the gun issue. Right now, the gun issue is as hot as you can get as much done as you want. And the bill they passed in the 90s under Clinton will not go.
That's true.
Period. Because they got a lot. Money counts. And when you let a group that can collectively stifle things and you don't hold them accountable individually, it doesn't matter what. How many speeches the president gives?
Well, Dan, look, I agree with you. Look, I used to work in Congress, so I know how dysfunctional Congress is. I've seen it firsthand. And you're absolutely right, with particularly the Senate filibuster, which also I've been trying very hard to reform. But the thing that Ronald Reagan did, and I am not at all a fan of Ronald Reagan's policies, but I do have a grudging respect for his political skills. But the thing that Ronald Reagan did, and frankly Bill Clinton did as well, is they went above the heads of Congress. They went right to the American people, and they said this is wrong.
What did Clinton get done? Explain one thing Clinton got done.
He got the Family Medical Leave Act done. That was pretty good. He got, you probably don't like the welfare to work requirement.
I do. I don't mind.
All right. He got that done. He raised taxes in 1993 on the rich and gave us a strong economy.
But they lost the house.
They did lose the house.
And then you know what he did? Then you know what he did after he got 53% of the vote in 1996? You know what he did? He did a tax cut in 97. He made it easier for robo foreclosures because the lien and the mortgage didn't have to be in the same place.
But
then he regulated the banks.
He had a Republican Congress, though. That was the problem.
But he had Democrats in there. Democrats couldn't filibuster all of that.
No, maybe they could have filibustered some of it. That's true. But they definitely had a Republican Congress who was writing the agenda.
You're in a 50-50 category. You're 50-50. If it's 50-50, then you should have been able to filibuster. Republicans got 40. They have 40 now, and they filibuster everything.
It's a fair point. It's a fair point. I want to see this article that Stephen Brill written in Time magazine. I want to see President Obama start quoting from this article. Because
it's not going to matter because you already got a Congress. You already gave the Republicans a pass that they voted against. They've only voted with Obama 5% of the time, and the left is only talking about Obama. That's where they won. Once you focus on him, win, lose, or draw, and let the Republicans play their head, I win, tails, you lose philosophy forever.
I want to be very clear. I mean, my criticism is friendly criticism. I mean, I know that the
there
Republicans...
There is no such thing as friendly criticism.
I think there is. President...
And if you put it in the context of this, Republicans, when the Democrats are in office, their thing is to run out the clock. That's what their whole thing. They've been on vacation. I want the left to come out and talk about the fact that Republicans are trying to destabilize the government. You say that, and then I'll get on President Obama for going out
I say that every
drugs.
Day, Dan. I talk about the filibuster. I talk about the Republicans being in the pocket of big oil and big pharmaceutical companies and big
but
military.
Being in the pocket because that's on both sides. I can get around that by just saying both sides do that.
Well, Republicans far more so. The gun manufacturing industry. What they're really doing with the filibuster is they're against democracy. And also they're against people voting because they're the ones who want the voting lines to be long and the photo IDs and the other things that Democratic voters, minority voters, or older or poorer voters don't have. The Republicans have been trying to steal our democracy at least ever since Bush v. Gore, probably earlier, and it's stuff I talk about all the time. I just want to be clear here. I am glad that President Obama got through Obamacare. I supported the Affordable Health Care Act. I think it's definitely better than where we were beforehand. My only point is that some of this rhetoric that I didn't hear from the president that's written in this wonderful article, if people really knew how much we are getting screwed over by these hospitals and insurance companies and the specific facts of how they take a dollar thing and they charge $100 for it, I think it's the kind of thing that can actually change the conversation. I think the guns, for example, we're going to get a background check only because President Obama has worked very hard since Newtown, and not really before, but since Newtown, to really bring the gun issue to the fore. So I'm just saying that there is a bully pulpit and that he can use the rhetoric more. And I'll give him this credit. I think he's done a lot more in the last couple years than he did in his first 2 years to use his perch to spread the word.
But here's the thing, though. You keep missing this. It doesn't matter what the bully pulpit is. What's that shit? There's one fourth. But then there's another force of equal. So, in other words, I can talk about Canada all I want. But if the fact that the liberal agenda for health care is rejected by the American people, see, they know you're headed. The reason we can't get health care through is because we know liberals aren't going to stop there. Liberals are going to be like, you're going to have people on welfare suing over health benefits. That's what the because majority of American people believe.
But see, Dan,
so they stop you at every, they stop your agenda at the beginning so they don't have to deal with it. Like, that's what he's faced with.
The beauty of the Time magazine article is that it doesn't talk about a liberal agenda or welfare benefits. It just simply points out the massive overcharging that hospitals and doctors do. If
Can
we were to regulate
question?
That alone, we would come a long way forward. But go ahead.
Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
How long have we known that the federal government, that the right wing funds to drain the treasury, part of their tactic? How long have we known how much they pay for hammers? How long have we known?
At least since the Reagan era. So that's
at least
30 years. Right.
Mm-hmm. And it never changes. And the American people, when you poll them on issue after issue, if it's something in your personal life, whether you have insurance or you don't have insurance, 80% of American people believe that's a personal responsibility. That means if I'm a high school dropout, then that means I only am worthy of the level of health insurance I can pay. That's the fundamental thing.
Yeah, but Dan, that's a separate issue, all right? The issue of who can pay for it, which is what Obamacare deals with and is an important issue, is a very important issue. I'm not knocking that issue. I'm arguing a different issue. I'm arguing how much they charge. The issue of who can pay for it, how much you pay for it, who should pay for it, that's all important. But to me, the one thing we should all be able to agree on as Americans, frankly, liberals and conservatives, whether you love Obama or hate Obama, we can all agree that hospitals shouldn't charge you $100 for a piece of gauze that costs 50 cents at your local pharmacy. That's something to me that we can all agree on and not have to get into complex questions of socialism and who pays for it and things like that.
Everything is intertwined. So for instance, you mentioned the monopoly.
Right.
The Democratic Party had that in their hands with control of all three houses, and they killed it. They killed pharmacy reform. They killed Medicare for all.
Well, look, you're right that a couple Democrats did not give us the 60 votes we needed. By the way, we had as much as 55 to 57 votes for Medicare for all. It really was just 3 to 5 members, Ben Nelson from Nebraska, Joe Lieberman from Connecticut. There were very few that were against it, but you're right. We didn't get the 60 we needed. But my point is that President Obama, had he gone on more of a worldwide tour and had given examples, bring up these people that are mentioned in Stephen Brill's article and say, this is Janice, and she went to the hospital for indigestion, and she was charged $25,000, and this is Shirley, and she has cancer, and before she died, her family had to pay $500,000, and really bring it home with real-life people.
Did you watch the Democratic Convention?
Yeah,
I
did.
That's what the whole thing was.
Well, not
That's
enough.
That's what they did.
Not enough.
That's what they did.
They did some
it's
of it.
It's not going to work if I buy you. If you're bought, there's nothing, there's no argument unless the people take you out. Either you follow what the people tell you that elected you, or
I understand, Dan, but
how many issues are 80% the American people are with 80% that the Congress won't do? How many? If the list is
Guns is one of them.
Yeah.
So it happens. Hey, Dan, I'm afraid my time's about up, but I've really enjoyed this discussion. I hope you call back next Sunday. We can have a longer one. Fair enough?
Okay.
All right. Yep. Thanks so much. Thanks. I'll tell you, Dan, I really appreciate people are passionate like Dan because we agree. I mean, Dan and I agree on what needs to be done. We just disagree on the strategy. And for me, that's part of what Progressive Radio is all about, trying to work out how we can get these good things done and do it in a way that, is the best strategy for success. But my time is up. This is the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine. If you want to hear me, I am on every Sunday from 1 to 3 p.m. on We Act Radio. And then from noon to 1, we have the Raucous Caucus, where I join Garland Nixon and Terry DeKester on the issues of the day. So every Sunday, noon to 3, make it a point to tune in to We Act Radio, AM 1480. And also, you can hear it all live streamed from my website at marklevinetalk.com. Follow me on Twitter at marklevinetalk. Go to my webpage. Go to Facebook, my fan page. Let me know what you thought of today's show. But for now, that's all the time I've got. I'm signing off.